Thank you for joining us at the OT Corner with Mrs. K. Please note this podcast does not intend to offer medical advice or therapeutic treatment for any medical condition for either yourself or others. If you have any medical or rehabilitation concerns for yourself or your child, please contact your physician. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the OT Corner with Mrs. K., a school-based occupational therapist bringing you a series of interviews and information on childhood development for kids with all different abilities. So get ready, get set, let's go.
Welcome to the OT Corner with Mrs. K. Today, I am excited to share with you a discussion I recently had with a colleague and friend of mine, Carol Conway, who is a retired pediatric occupational therapist with over 40 years of experience specializing in school-based practice. And Carol and I sat down and started discussing initially, you know, how occupational therapy has evolved over the course of the past 50 years and how laws and legislation are affecting our scope of practice. And as we were discussing this, we started talking more about legislation and the multi-tiered system of approach in the school systems across all disciplines, and which led on to other conversations. And so, in short, what I'm telling you is that this episode was only supposed to be one episode. Now it is two, and there's going to be a part one and part two. So today we are primarily discussing the evolution and the role of OT since the 1970s in the school systems, as well as talking about how law and legislations, particularly Every Student Succeeds Act, and how that law has affected our scope of practice in the school systems. Welcome today, Carol Conway, to the OT Corner. Hi, Carol. Thanks so much for coming on today and discussing the importance of how law impacts how occupational therapists practice in the school systems. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thanks so much. I really appreciate being asked to be here. I care so passionately about this work.
I do too. And we were just discussing, we've had a couple conversations before talking today about, when did all this start? Obviously, it started with IDEA, and how this shapes our scope of practice. Like how has our scope of practice changed, and how does that look in the school systems?
So I'm glad you asked that. So I think it's really important for us to understand that back in the 70s, there were some amazing lobbyists who lobbied for OT, speech, PT to be in the schools. That has impacted our profession and impacted schools from 1970s on. It's interesting to note that other countries do not have laws that put OTs and other related service people in the schools. So what we're doing is kind of being leaders, and I'm actually involved in some other groups where people from different countries are trying to learn how to do school-based OT. So back in the 70s, the first law, which actually has been reauthorized, so I think it had a different title, but we now refer to it as IDEA, which is the Individual Disabilities Education Act, put OTs in the schools as related service personnel. Related service meaning that our job is to help children participate in schools. And as OTs, I think it's really important for us to really focus on the word participation, because participation is all about occupations. What are the occupations of school? Now, what has happened over time is, especially from the beginning, no one knew what to do with us in schools. And actually, our professors back in the early, late 70s and 80s had not even worked in schools, but were developing school-based practice. And so We went into the schools and we started really doing a medical model. IDEA is a caseload model. Kids have to be identified as special education, which there's a process that they go through for an evaluation by the team who then recommends services. We started doing a medical model, and I don't believe that was what the law states. So if you look at the law says that our job is to help kids participate in school in the least restrictive environment alongside their peers to the maximum extent possible. I've been a school-based OT, for over 30 years, and in the beginning, I really just didn't pay that much attention to the least restrictive environment. Kind of was doing the medical model that other people were doing and thinking, oh yeah, the least restrictive environment might be my therapy room or maybe the special education room. But the law doesn't state that. What we can do, we can do our entire scope of practice. But I don't know about you, Jennifer, but it feels like many years people were just doing fine motor, handwriting, sensory, and we were leaving out things like vocational and academic work, leisure, social participation, mental health, even physical health, sleep and rest. I don't know, was that then your experience too?
I believe it, yes, it is. And I think that's a lot of times teachers come to me more with the handwriting issues, the sensory issues, which I can handle. That's part of my practice. But there's so many opportunities that I see that we could be working in as well. I love the idea of the lunch buddies that my daughter has at her school. I think one year I was able to kind of infiltrate one of the classrooms. And we had a kid that was, I was supposed to be seeing for just intervention, just he wasn't on my caseload. And the teacher and I came up with a yoga routine that they did as a classroom. So it was working on core strength because he was having a hard time with sitting in his chair for long periods of time. So what we did is we did some core strengthening with yoga, a yoga practice, and they did it in the gym. It was like 5 or 10 minutes in the morning. I gave her the program, I showed her, and she did it like every morning before they went into breakfast because they do breakfast at that school. So that was a great opportunity, but that was something that I was involved with. The teacher and I worked together, and not only did it help that kid, but it helped the entire class. And it opened her eyes onto some other students that really started to benefit from that. But those experiences are far and few between, to tell you the truth. And not only that, I am a contract occupational therapist, which means I am not hired by the districts. I work for a contract agency, which is a wonderful company. I love it. But we are like almost like a guest in the school, and it's hard to, in that type of model, sometimes I find it more difficult to have those experiences that I had with that one classroom. So yes, that mostly it's handwriting and sensory. What do I do here? But I definitely see where we could be in, more opportunities. And I find it interesting, we were discussing this earlier, but when I first started as an OT and I didn't start in schools, I started in more medical model settings, hospitals and rehab facilities. It was an eye-opener when I found out how reimbursement is really driven by legislation and the federal government. I didn't really, it was just a big eye-opener because I didn't really have that education initially when I was in school that would impact my practice so much. So it's really interesting to me to start here where it all began, how it's evolved over what, 50 years now, right?
Yeah, we're coming on our 50th year, I believe, of IDEA's authorization. Yes, you're correct on that.
Carol is also involved on the leadership team for a mental health care initiative called Every Moment Counts. Now, this mental health care initiative was started by one of my occupational therapy professors, Dr. Susan Basic, and it contributes to the development and implementation of several model programs that emphasize integrated services. And Carol provides consultative and collaborative support to school-based practices. and she emphasizes health and mental health and physical health, also inclusion and interdisciplinary collaboration. This has led Carol to present at the local, state, and national and international level, as well as publish some articles about the about inclusion in integrated services.
Probably in the introduction, you've talked about my work with Every Moment Counts. So my focus on there was integration and inclusion. And one of the things that I learned when I was evaluating a new student or reevaluating, when I was looking at that part of the IEP that said location of services, I changed how I thought. My first thought was, where in the gen ed setting can I see the student who has multiple disabilities or has mild disabilities? But the law says that's my job. My job is, where can I see this child alongside his peers? Now, maybe it's I can't, or maybe I can only do it a small part of the time, and then I might need to go to a small group intervention. But perhaps that small group intervention is not just children on IEPs, but it's children on IEPs and their peers. So that's still considered, in my district, was considered a gen ed setting because they have access to peers, which is words from the law. So then if I move down the continuum, because we know that all kids can be seen like that, maybe it's a small group intervention with just students on IEPs. Group processing is so important.
We have a whole class on it in OT school, group process.
Exactly. And then if I move further down the continuum, that's when I get to pull out individual therapy. Okay. Mm-hmm. I've had opportunities actually to speak around the country, and even actually I was in Ireland recently, and people seem to start at pull out therapy because mm-hmm. I think it's what they know, it's what they're comfortable with, it's what the districts are used to. And so I was really challenged probably about 15 years ago to start really thinking differently, looking at the law and also looking at the evidence that says, no, you know, pull out individual therapy is clinic-based therapy, which is important, but it's not helping all the time, helping kids participate in the occupations of school. What the evidence tells us is that children need to practice the skill they are learning in the environment that they need the skill in. I mean, and we know, we see that. We can get children to do something in individual therapy, but it doesn't transfer over into the classroom or into the lunchroom or into you know, the computer lab, wherever they need it to be. So our evidence tells us where we need to be is in the environment they need the skill in. Perhaps there's a little bit of pull out to practice a skill to get them ready, but not all year.
Exactly, yeah. Or if we're introducing a new skill. Like a lot of times I find that pull out mm-hmm. service is really good for introducing a new skill. But quite honestly, I would say 90% of my practice is pull out because that's the model that's expected, I guess. And I find it though, I will say this, that might be a high percentage. Over the past year or so, I have been finding that I have been able to go into the classroom more and more. And really, I'm just there to support them. I want the best for the kid. And I want to see like you said, when you pull out, I always think to myself, well, this might be changing the data that I'm collecting because I'm providing all these adaptations and modifications on a one-on-one basis. But how is that kid going to do that in the classroom without me? And the teacher can't give the attention. They've got a bunch of other kids to work with, so they can't give that attention. So how can this work in the classroom? So
that's such a good point because that data collection, we do see changes. The changes are much slower to come into the classroom. They may come, but it might take so much longer to get there because you're teaching them a new skill. Most of the time it's one time a week in an isolated mm-hmm. block okay. setting. Evidence does not support the transition of that knowledge quickly or even slowly into the other environment. And so I know that, you know, was a frustration to me. It's like, I could get them to do it in the therapy room, but it wasn't being carried over. But I wanted to mention to you about how you're going into support teachers. So that's fabulous. So What we're talking about now is we used to talk about the consulting therapist where you kind of come in and you're the expert. You come in, well, this is how you do it. I'll give you all these resources and then I'll leave and maybe I'll check back. And the next time I walk in, you're like, oh boy, I haven't done a thing because I'm too busy teaching. So we now talk about coaching, a coaching model, which is a collaborative approach where you do problem solving together. Takes a little bit more time, but it solves a lot more problems and you learn from each other. So I have learned so much from the teachers that I've worked with to help me be a better therapist. And then I'm hoping and I'm sure that they have learned from me. So I was kind of switching from like 25% push in. By the time I retired about a year ago, I was doing 85% of co-teaching, pushing in, being in natural environments. And I can tell you from personal experience that what I saw was so much growth for my students. And it made me love my job. I had more, I saw teachers doing some of the things that I had shared with them. I could walk down the hall and hear things going on in the classroom of language, of adaptations, all those kinds of things that would never have happened if I would have stayed in my therapy room. If we look at what IDEA says we should do, that we could, that would really challenge us to maybe do it differently.
Now, in 2002, the Bush administration put into place the No Child Left Behind Act, and basically, it was a law that stated that there were standards that educational systems needed to uphold for their students when they're educating their students. So, and there was some controversy around that law, but when President Obama came into office, he signed in to law something that was an extension of the No Child Left Behind Act, which was called, which is called the Every Student Succeeds Act. Now, the focus on the Every Student Succeeds Act is that it ensures all students receive a high quality education that prepares them for post-graduation. So it's looking at all students, not just students with disabilities. And Carol and I go on to discuss what this law states and how this shapes how they deliver their services in the educational system.
The Every Student Succeeds Act, which was signed by Obama in 2015. It was formerly part of the No Child Left Behind. And what's different about ESSA, which is how we refer to it, is that it is a general education law versus IDEA, which is a law for children with disability. The general umbrella of ESSA is that it focuses on states developing programs and implementing these plans for creating school environments that help students be healthy, both physical and mental health. Okay. And it's all students, and it's using that multi-systems support, the MTSS. And we'll go into that a little bit more. But under ESSA, OTs are considered are identified as specialized instruction support personnel, another acronym for us.
I know.
And that's it refers to all those people who support students, like OTs, PTs, speech, school counselors, psychologists, nurses. Okay. We all have a role with all children, not just the caseload IEP children, in promoting physical as well as mental health. This legislation provides explicit support for OT practitioners to contribute to health promotion and prevention efforts and the creation of positive environments for learning. And I think about OTs, think about what we walk into a classroom and we do an environmental scan, right? We look, it's just something that I think is inbred as OTs, as you begin to work and you just look at how can I make this environment better, not only for the student who's on IEP, but for all students. We know that every child is a sensory being and that they process sensory information differently, process sensory environments differently. So we've been focusing on just our tier three or students who with disabilities, but really we can help teachers look at their environments and create one that's promotes learning.
When you were talking about that, it's interesting. So one thing that I find it difficult sometimes when I'm writing goals specifically for a student now, because now I'm moving. I honestly have been, I do fine motor, obviously, and I do sensory, but I've also started working on executive functioning skills for kiddos.
Yes.
And not only that, you know, I always thought more of executive functioning as something that's more starting to really come about in middle school, high school years, but I'm thinking more in the elementary, that mm-hmm. it's really important that we work on that. And so what do I mean by that? Like looking at how they accommodate, say, if they have poor working memory or planning out a task. And, you know, really as an OT, we are activity analysis experts. So when we walk into, and that just doesn't mean like a specific activity, it can mean an environmental in the context. So like the classroom, why is everybody, you know, having issues? Or, you know, if one student is having sensory issues, it sets everybody else off. And how can we, what's trying to get to the root of the problem? I guess what I'm trying to get at is when I'm thinking about OTs and this mental health or this keeping these kids healthy, you know, that's really our basic need, right? Is
mm-hmm.
healthy, being safe, having proper nutrition. And if we don't have any of that, then all the higher level learning is just not going to happen. And then you're going to miss developmental milestones through that kind of, you know, if that's not established. So when I'm writing a goal, I'm really trying to, that's where I'm starting to struggle, have like, how do I label this goal?
I totally know what you mean. So a lot of times, and as I got better at being, a therapist who went into the classroom and was doing more co-teaching with teachers and things like that, I started writing more collaborative goals with teachers. And so oftentimes I asked the teacher, what do you need the student to do in your classroom? Like, what is it? Like, especially around this idea of being able to attend, to focus, to follow routines. And I think we went through a variety of what we call the goal. I think it was more important about what the behavior or the outcome would be. I always felt like it was a very powerful way to do it because I wanted to know what the teacher really saw as the problem. And maybe if I needed to help her tweak it or we tweaked it together. But it's this idea, like sometimes we went to self-regulation and called it a self-regulation go, but we've kind of moved beyond that because now we really recognize co-regulation as being this goal, this ability to be able to co-regulate with the children, other children or students in the class, as well as the adults. We've sometimes called it a social communication participation goal. We kind of got away from a behavior goal because I think it has a negative connotation. You know, that trying to use some type of strength-based title and also writing strength-based goals. So it's like, what do we want the child to do as opposed to what we don't want the child to do? You know, the real push for promoting mental health for all students and social emotional learning. I have gone to use the content standards, social emotional content standards that are provided by most states and just called it whatever content standard we were addressing. Sometimes it's self-awareness. So directly pulled from those content standards. And I think those are great because they're developmentally appropriate.
That's the need that we're looking at. What is the need? You know, you're really focused. And that's what, you know, when you're doing your evaluations. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you said attention and focus, because I have labeled my goal attention mm-hmm. and focus. Mm-hmm. And I've, you know, benchmark those type of goals because I want it to be a certain attention and focus over a period of, you know, each semester we're working on something, increasing the amount of time, whatever. I haven't used social participation, but I find that interesting because I administer the sensory processing measure all the time. And that is one of the categories. social communication and planning and ideas. So, you know, and that goes along with that executive functioning stuff.
I use the sensory processing measure social participation to measure change and also to look at the goals. I could pull something right from there. But this idea of instead of focus and attention, maybe the goal is more strength-based and participation-based. We'll be able to participate in a small group project towards completion. I think we get caught up on really looking at minutiae when maybe we could look at a little bit more gestalt. As researchers and data collectors, we kind of really want those measurable goals, but maybe if we look at task completion or small group participation, those are occupations of school. Those are things that kids need to be successful in to be successful in school. Not because attention, depending on all those other things that are going on in child's life, it can be really good one day and maybe very difficult another day.
You know, whatever's going on at home too really affects,
of course,
affects kids. And it's funny, we just did the occupational therapy assistant I work with in one of my school systems. We work really closely together, and we were just working on the new goal for a kiddo that we have. And we were looking at his data, and he had some regression over the, he was doing really well throughout the whole year. And there's just been some personal things in his life that have happened, and it's really affecting him at school. We have that information. We have that piece of information, and we're able to talk to the teacher about it and come up with a goal that really will support his need right now.
So we talk about that when in Every Moment Counts a lot, when about situational stressors, things that happen in a child's life. It can be something that's temporary, maybe something, you know, there's a death in the home, a death of a pet, or it could be something more significant like poverty or incarceration of a family member. But those situational stressors impact a child's ability to be successful in school. And so they're going to need some supports, and then they're not going to be pull-out supports. It's going to be a recognition of that. And those are those promotion and prevention strategies that can be embedded throughout the day that help students like that. So, and I think, like, you know, again, you're an OT, so you might be working on some of the fine motor sensory things that you're talking about, but you cannot take that the lens of mental health out of your work. So what we found in Every Moment Counts, and we talked to therapists, is that OTs, is that they were addressing mental health all the time, but they're not talking about it. So what we've tried to do is empower OTs to start talking about it, because most of us are just doing it because it's just who we are and how we were trained. So it's great that you notice that and have changed how you're seeing.
Finally, Carol and I discussed some of the specific programming that Carol implemented in her school district. And actually, my daughter was in Carol's school district, so she was able to participate in some of these activities and some of these groups that Carol and her colleagues came up with to address the mental health, as well as just being able to function in the school environment. And again, these were students that had disabilities and students that did not have disabilities. And they were very creative programs that made a huge difference in these kids' lives. And you also, some of the things that you've done, I know that you've done the Lunch Buddies, but what are some of the other programs that you've used? Because I think one of the other things that is a challenge in the school systems is we're not allowed to pull them out of certain things.
Yes.
Recess, any specials, mm-hmm. You can't do that. And then certain class or instruction time too. Right. Instruction time where you're not allowed to pull them,
yes.
Which makes it very challenging.
It does.
To find time to see your kid. I love some of the programming that you have used. Like I said, the Lunch Buddies. What were some of the other programs that you used in order to get some direct time?
Yeah, so great question. Thanks for asking that. So first of all, I'll have to say that I was an employee of the district. So I think that sets up a little bit differently because I was in the same buildings for many years. So I was that ability to develop relationships with teachers, happens over time, you know, and we know in all we do, relationships are really important and building trust. And so that helped me over time. So I started small, but I was able to really make changes. So I ran Lunch Buddy groups, and Lunch Buddies was a group of kids with significant disabilities and their peers. And we could do that at lunch because I'm not pulling peers out of anything. And it was a volunteer position. So I would go into a classroom. I would say, this is, and I did it with a speech therapist, sometimes with a teacher, sometimes with a school counselor, but mainly with a speech therapist. So it was always co-taught. And I would just go into a gen ed classroom and say, we're running this Lunch Buddies program. This is what it is. If you'd like to be a buddy, sign up. And we often got more buddies than we needed, so we had to rotate them through. So it would be a small group intervention with kids with and without disabilities, and we would share a meal together. And I like to say share a meal because that's what we should be doing: sitting down, eating together, having conversations. Sometimes we would develop some kind of conversational starters, or we would do some type of small activity while we were sitting around a table. So it could be six kids, and then sometimes we get so many buddies, we could have 15 kids, the group dynamics change. I also would run recess buddies. So I'm not taking kids out of recess. I'm forming a relationship of same thing. It's a buddy, come here. We're going to play games. A lot of indoor recess in Northeast Ohio. We did board games, card games. We did obstacle courses. We played in the gym. And it was always play with peers with and without disabilities. And I think OTs don't think about lunch and recess programs or times of the day. Important times of the day. We often ask people, adults, when they think back of the elementary, what were their favorite times of the day? And they were lunch and recess for most people. You know, that time to be with peers. And a lot of our kids with disabilities don't have that opportunity to play or interact or socially participate. Other options I did is that I would do for I worked mainly grades 3 through 5, but then I've done all the way up through high school. But it's always easier to push in those earlier elementary, the speech therapist and I would develop social emotional curriculum lessons, and we would push into gen ed classrooms where we had kids on IEPs with mild and moderate disabilities. And we would ask teachers, what are the problems you're having? How can we help you? And we were going to do a pull-out small group with some peers, but they said, you know, I think everybody in our class would benefit from this lesson. And so we would, you know, so we did that once a week for maybe 10 weeks, and then we did small group intervention. We would push into those same classrooms during their writing class, okay? And the teachers would have developed the lesson, all right? So it was their turn to develop the lesson, and we supported that lesson, whether it would be keyboarding, handwriting, voice to text, whatever kids needed help. And we did focus on kids with IEPs, but then we would help all kids, and the kids were in the gen ed classroom. So those are some of the examples of things that I did for groups and, you know, working inside the classroom and co-teaching.
I always love talking with Carol because she is an amazing occupational therapist and inspires me to really push myself and to think about ESSA and what it says I should be doing in the school systems. And actually, all of us that are occupational therapists and related service providers, teachers, educators in general. This is just to make sure that the student is getting exactly what they need. And again, not just students with disabilities, but students without disabilities, because it really does make an impact on how they function in the school environment. Next week, we will be continuing the conversation, Carol and myself, where we dive more into ESSA and the multi-tier system of services, and also data collection, and how we measure our progress with some of these different approaches towards our occupational therapy practice in the schools. So tune in next week. And also, I am going to be providing some resources to Every Moment Counts that Carol gave me. That link will be in the show notes below. And if you do have any questions, please feel free to email me at jennifer@theotcorner.com. Have a wonderful week, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the OT Corner with Mrs. K. Feel free to join the OT Corner community by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. If you have a topic you want to hear about, or if you would like to come on the show, feel free to contact Jennifer at theotcorner.com. We would love to hear from you. All information from the show is listed in the episode notes. We know you can listen to anyone, so we appreciate you stopping by. Until next time, thanks again.